Representative Vogel, did you have a chance to review the minutes from February 14th?
Yes, I move approval.
All right. Said motion is made. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion carries. House File 179. Representative Scott, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have an amendment that I'd like to offer, the A1.
The A1 amendment. Representative Scott, please describe your amendment.
The A1 amendment requires the Department of Public Safety to basically get a law passed when they have a rule change in the ignition interlock program.
Any discussion? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have that requirement in any other area of the law for any other agency?
Representative Scott.
I'm sure we do, but I'm not aware of what they are.
Representative Hillstrom?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to know if this is unprecedented or if this is common practice or, you know, why we're doing it this particular way.
Is Representative Hillstrom, is that a question or a comment?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll let her adopt her amendment and we'll just see how the testimony goes and I'll decide later how many more questions I'm going to ask.
I will take that as a comment. Thank you. Representative Lesch.
Well, Mr. Chair, I was just going to say I think it is a good question, and I think there's a good answer, but I guess we'll just wait. So I support the amendment.
Any other discussion about the amendment? All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed nay. The motion carries. Representative Scott, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 179 does address the Ignition Interlock Program. The Ignition Interlock Program became law in 2010, and it's been a great success and no doubt has saved countless lives by disabling the vehicles of program participants when they attempt to drive after consuming alcohol. People have had their driver's licenses canceled or revoked due to one or more DWI offenses can volunteer, although for some folks it is a mandatory program, to participate in the Ignition Interlock Program and have certain driving privileges reinstated. This allows participants to get to jobs, treatment programs, etc. This last year we learned that DPS had a new requirement that all devices be wireless and provide real-time reporting. Although my staff and I have discovered by talking with all five vendors certified in the state of Minnesota that some vendors can turn off the GPS technology or the location tracking technology and still provide real-time reporting, the fact remains that the Department of Public Safety overreached its authority and may have violated certain program participants' rights by not informing them that they were potentially being tracked. Additionally, once again, the Department of Public Safety went around the legislature by making a significant change in a program when they should have sought a change in law. Since this revelation, DPS has ignored the requests and recommendations of legislators and stakeholders to set aside the January 1st, 2017 implementation of this new requirement until it could be more fully vetted. Only an injunction issued as a result of a lawsuit brought by one of the vendors that called into question the possible constitutional violations of this requirement finally stopped the implementation of this new requirement. So what does House File 179 do? When the law was passed in 2010, it contained language that exempted DPS from the rulemaking process for this program so as to speed up its implementation. My bill reinstates this rulemaking process. And again, the amendment goes one step further by requiring any new rules regarding the Ignition Interlock Program to have legislative approval, basically being signed into law. Given the track record of DPS of making significant policy changes, in particular in regard to the purchase and implementation of technologies that threaten the privacy of law-abiding citizens, I believe this step is warranted. This bill also prohibits the use of devices equipped with location tracking capabilities unless location tracking capabilities are disabled. I want to remind members of the hearing we had at the beginning of session regarding the subject. We asked DPS why they wanted real-time reporting and the ability to track participants. They clearly stated they had no interest in tracking participants. They merely wanted the report of someone who blew a bad blow in real time so that they could contact these folks as soon as possible to let them know they were involved, that they were in violation, and that their time on the program had been extended. They said this would cut down on recidivism. The purpose of this bill is obvious. Program participants cannot simply have the rules changed on them midstream. And DPS cannot abuse their power by making significant changes in the Ignition Interlock program without oversight and transparency. And that concludes my opening remarks, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Question, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make one comment about the statements made by Representative Scott. The very nature of the folks that are on these Ignition Interlock programs are people who have been or are currently charged with DWI. So the fact that they're law-abiding citizens is not accurate, Representative Scott. I don't disagree with the premise of what you're trying to do with the bill, but you don't have to be inflaming when you're attempting to do it.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
And I should have clarified my sentence a little bit better. Perhaps that's true on this program, but other times that DPS has abused their power when it involves any sort of tracking technology, they are tracking, they did track law-abiding citizens for no reason, and I can cite those technologies if you want me to, but it has happened where they have tracked.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is not currently part of this bill, but I'd be happy to have you list those for us, and if you want to bring proposals to take care of those as well, that might be the proper time to talk about them.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And we have had to address those issues in the past, cell phone tracking devices, the license plate reader technologies that the Department of Public Safety, that they acquired these technologies without any policy from the legislature surrounding those. And we do know that license plate readers regularly capture the license plates and the locations of law-abiding citizens and keep that information. So with that, Mr. Chair, I think we have some testifiers.
Very well. Yes. up first is Mr. Charlie Klippert. Is he in the room? Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Yes. Thank you. My name is Charles Clippert. I'm the president of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and our organization supports the House File 179. We got wind of this GPS tracking this summer and became very concerned because the USB Jones, or the Jones decision, the United States Supreme Court decision prohibits GPS tracking unless you have a warrant. And it appears that there is no warrant requirement here. I got to back up. I think I'm a criminal law practitioner. I've been doing this over 20 years. And the Ignition Interlock program has been great because so many times our clients get buried in with the DPS, and it's really difficult for them to get their license back. So to have people get on the road and be monitored is a great situation, make sure they're not drinking and driving. But that's what this program should be limited to, is to make sure people aren't drinking and driving. And any expansion of the program beyond that without some legislative oversight is a real troublesome matter. There may be a time where this body says, okay, we want to have limited GPS tracking on certain people, and I may be on the other side of a bill, Representative Scott, but I think that should come at a time after we've had a chance to discuss what's the nature of the data. Is the data public? Is the data private? Who controls the data? And to make sure that the data is secure and make sure it's being used for proper purposes. So at this stage, I think House File 179 makes a lot of sense to make sure that this data is not being collected and to make sure the data is being protected. I know Representative Hillstrom had said that some of these people are, not law-abiding citizens, but some of these people are maybe people who've gotten DWIs a number of years ago and are still trying to get their license back. So, and that person, by agreeing to be on this Ignition Interlock program, shouldn't be subject to constant government surveillance. So.
Any questions or comments for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Up next to testify is Mr. Ben Feist. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is, and members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director with the ACLU of Minnesota. I'll start by thanking Representative Scott for bringing this timely and important bill before us today. To be clear, the ACLU does not oppose the Ignition Interlock program itself. As others have already said, keeping drunk drivers off the roads is very important public policy. However, GPS tracking does pose significant intrusions into the privacy rights of Minnesotans. The most intimate details of our lives, such as where and how we worship, the people with whom we associate, and where and when we receive medical care, can easily be ascertained by the government by GPS tracking of our vehicles. We've had similar concerns with automatic license plate readers, cell phone tracking, and other types of warrantless surveillance over the last several years. As already been mentioned, the U.S. v. Jones case is very clear when the Supreme Court unanimously found that attaching a GPS device to a vehicle to track its movements constitutes a search under the Fourth Amendment, and accordingly the government would need a warrant based on probable cause before obtaining that information. Based on some information that we've recently learned from vendors, the capability is certainly here for tracking, and that information can and possibly is being used by law enforcement. So we do have serious problems with this. It makes sense that Ignition Interlock would be used to stop drunk driving. It does not make sense that this should be a location tracking tool at this time. Happy to answer any questions.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree. When you've talked to the vendors, do all of the vendors in Minnesota have the ability to turn that GPS off, or are there some vendors that will no longer be able to provide that service here in Minnesota?
Mr. Feist.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, I haven't had direct conversations with all of the vendors. I think Representative Scott might be able to answer that a little bit better. The only thing I know is really from testimony that was provided in the other body, and I don't think that issue came up directly.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and Mr. Feist. I have kind of a devil's advocate question. Isn't it true that the U.S. v. Jones decision was predicated on a trespass on the vehicle to which the tracking device was attached?
Mr. Feist.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, in terms of how that case specifically came down as decision, but they did have everyone on the court agree that by attaching the GPS device, it was a search. And so while it was just a plurality, I think it's pretty clear the direction that the court is willing to go on this.
Well, Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Feist, I would hope that would be the direction that the court goes. However, the concurring opinion in U.S. v. Jones stated that there was, in fact, new technology that could be out there, which tracks someone's location wherever they go, but that's expressly not what they were deciding in the opinion. So I just, for purposes of being devil's advocate, I would like U.S. v. Jones to be as clear-cut as that. I don't think it necessarily is at that point, at this point anyway, and it could go another way.
Mr. Feist, any comments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, I don't disagree. We, too, would like to see more clarity and the court to get more involved in these types of cases. As you know, it takes years to move these things forward, and technology is simply advancing too fast. So our belief is that the state of Minnesota should take a step back here and, looking at those types of precedents, make sure that what we're doing is good public policy and that we're not invading the privacy of Minnesotans when the purpose of the program is to keep drunk drivers off the road.
Any other questions or comments for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Feist.
Thank you.
Up next is Mr. Brad Freilich. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Brad Freilich. I'm Director of Government Relations with a company called IntoxLock, and we are the largest provider of ignition lock devices here in the state of Minnesota. We are here to oppose this bill. specifically in regards to those interlocks that are put on for the purposes of court order. In those cases, the courts basically put out RFPs, and one of the requirements for that RFP is that the devices have all this technology, a camera, GPS, real-time reporting. The reason they do that, there are many reasons, but probably the primary one is to stop the crime of child endangerment, DUI, which is basically defined as where a person, in spite of all that technology that's in the vehicle, goes in, gets in the car, and in often cases has a minor in the car, and basically goes out and gets someone else to start the car for them. In other words, successfully give a breath test where they're sober. And then, as they're driving, because they have been drinking, when there's a rolling retest, they get caught. Under those court-ordered ignition interlocks, what happens is the court is immediately notified that that violation took place, that there's a crime being committed, and because of the GPS location at the time of that event, that rolling retest, which shows the direction of travel and the speed, the court is able to send out a squad car to go and pick up that person. These happen, unfortunately, relatively often. We get about once a month a case where someone is over 0.08, just with our company in the state of Minnesota, driving with a case 0.08, and about two-thirds of the time there is a child in the vehicle. We just had a case in New Ulm where a person went out, first a male subject went out, tried to start the car, they were at a 0.023, could not start the car. Then the person who was in the program, the court-ordered program, came out. She was at 0.155. She could also not start it because of that BAC. And then finally they got a third person, a male subject, who came out, who was at 0.000, was successfully able to start the car. At that point, the woman got into the car with two kids in the back seat and was on her way. Now, she was caught at the first rolling retest. She took the test, and she blew a hot. The court was immediately notified, and because of that GPS coordinate there, they knew the direction that the car was traveling, the speed, and they were able to basically, you know, tell the squad car where to go, you know, where the car was at the time this happened, and pick up that person. As far as what has been talked about earlier when we talked about Jones and all of this, I don't think that applies here because, at least in the case of us, and my guess is the other vendors are the same way, is there is no secret placing of GPS on this. When they go in to get the install, they have to sign not only their lease, but there is basically it's a training document that certifies that they were trained on how to use the device. In that device, there is a disclosure that this device has real-time reporting, GPS, and there is a camera in the car. So they signed that before, so they are giving their consent. So I don't really think Jones is at issue here because it's really not, it's not involuntary. They know it's happening. So with that, I will take any questions.
Representative Scott.
I just wanted to make clear that in our conversations with the vendors, that there were a couple of vendors that said that in their contracts they don't have that disclosure that these new devices have GPS. So I wanted to make that clear.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Frelick, what company do you represent?
Intoxilock.
Mr. Frelick.
Thank you, Lesh. Mr. Chair and Mr. Frelick. I know I was only made aware kind of tangentially that there's sort of a kind of a fight between companies that like this and don't like this, and you're on the side of the companies that don't like it because you've already got the GPS on the machines that you put out. Is that right,
Mr. Frelick?
Well, yeah, that's true, but the companies that do business here, in fact, there's a total of eight companies that have this technology, including all the companies that do business here. They're using that technology in other states.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Mr. Frelick, you know, just because Wisconsin goes and jumps off a bridge doesn't mean we have to, okay? And second, I would ask you this. If you really maintain that this does not apply to a warrantless search because consent is given because you buried it somewhere in the fine print. Why was there such an uproar when suddenly everyone discovered that, wow, they're going to propose to use GPS to track where we are at all times? People freaked out. And yet you said they shouldn't have freaked out because they already knew they were being tracked. How do you reconcile those two disparities?
Well, I cannot speak for other people in what you describe as them freaking out. It's in the documents. It's disclosed beforehand. They don't have to go to our company. In Minnesota, there are many vendors that you can go to. You can choose who you want to go to.
Well, Representative Lett.
Ms. Chair and Mr. Fralick, I understand you run a business. You're there to make a profit. You got the machines in place. You don't want to have that technology that you invested capital in to be wasted. But the fact is you should have been tracking the conversations that have been going on here at the Capitol over the past 6 years about the sensitivity to warrantless searches, to new technologies being deployed that maybe haven't been advised to the legislature. It's an extremely sensitive topic up here, and we're trying to walk a very fine line. And U.S. v. Jones is one of those cases that we have to look at because new technologies are rolling out every single year that we decide, oh, all of a sudden we have to make a new policy about that again. And it gets papers stacked knee-high up here at the Capitol that we have to read through to determine whether or not citizens are enjoying the freedoms and protections that they expect. So that's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Mr. Fralick, a question. Can your company turn off the GPS component and still track in real time? Mr. Fralick.
Yes, we can turn off. In fact, when the injunction came down, we turned it off in about 10 minutes. The device has two-way communication, so we turned that off. So there is no, right now there is no GPS. We also contacted all the courts where we had contracts with them for the court-ordered ones, told them what was going on, and they said, well, we know our contract says you have to provide this, but because of what the injunction says, go ahead and turn those off. So they are turned off. All GPS is turned off right now in all. And, yes, we do have the ability to still do the real-time reporting.
So, Mr. Fralick, with that said, is it fair to say that this bill would not impact your technology or your product then?
As far as can we comply with the language? Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Scott, in the event that there was, in fact, a violation, so no longer a law-abiding citizen, someone is in the vehicle, and, in fact, it triggers that there is a violation, so they're blowing 0.15 or whatever it is, is there a way, based on your bill, for anyone, even if it is court-ordered, to find out what the location of that drunk driver is? Is there anything in the bill that would allow that to happen?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, spent some time in conversation about how that technology would actually happen, because do these vendors have somebody watching every single person on the Interlock program in the state of Minnesota? Do they have some way of immediately being notified that this has happened? And how do they then get in contact as quick, you know, in a short amount of time to go find the person that may have violated? And perhaps Mr. Fralick can answer that question, but we're trying to talk through the practicalities of the amount of staffing that it would take to find out if someone, especially in the case if there's a child in the backseat, do you automatically get pictures at the same time that you get the information that someone blows a bad blow? And so there were just some questions about practicality there. So,
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scott, I'm not asking if right now the technology is there to do it. My question is, in the event the technology becomes available to do exactly that, that there is no tracking, there is no keeping track until, in fact, there is a violation, would your law, as proposed, permit that to happen? Because ultimately none of us want someone who is blowing in violation of the statute to be allowed to continue driving, and we'd like them to be picked up. So my question is, would your language preclude that should the technology to do that become available?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the reasons I have added the amendment to this bill was that when, if the Department of Public Safety thinks that that's an important issue, Representative Hillstrom, that they come to the legislature and say, we want to have the capability to do this. And therefore, that's the justification for the amendment. They need to come, and in my opinion, that would require another change in law. The Department of Public Safety stated to us publicly that they just want real-time reporting so they can find out about the violation, send notice in the mail to the people that have violated and therefore had their sentences or their time on the program extended. And their statement over and over was this would prevent recidivism, and that's why they wanted the real-time reporting. So that's what I'm trying to address.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Scott. I understand that's what the Department of Public Safety testified, and I think that that's great. I also heard testimony from this gentleman that the court is looking for something else sometimes. And so my question is, does this preclude the court from ordering potentially that GPS tracking or that real-time, if there is a violation, reporting to the court with GPS coordinates?
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would have staff answer that question.
Members, Representative Hillstrom, I'm honestly not sure how that would work. If the court is ordering that the person participate in the program that's run by the commissioner, I'm not sure if the court could order the commissioner to conform the program to requirements of a court order, if that would also violate statute. I'm not sure. That would create some separation of powers issues for sure.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Well, the court could simply order saying you may only be on an ignition interlock program to get your license back as part of your probation if you have. And therefore, the person would be precluded from getting their license back if this technology was not made available. So that is my question. Look, members, we don't want people to not have the opportunity to get their license back if we want them to have their license back. Because we put obstacles in the way. We want to make sure that the program works the way that it's intended. We don't want people being tracked that we don't want to have tracked. I have seen people with as many as 9 felony DWIs in my career as a prosecutor. They have been in and out of prison. They come back. They get their license back. They go on ignition interlock. Some refuse to get on ignition interlock. Some violate. Some do all sorts of crazy things. When you have an alcohol problem, which most of these folks, when you have that many DWIs, have an alcohol problem, it does become a real public safety risk. So the question is, if they're not in prison and they're going to be driving, and the court specifically says you may only, in this particular case, have a driver's license, if I want to make sure that we are permitting the court to do what they need to do to keep the public safe. I don't want tracking of law-abiding citizens. I don't want GPS tracking of law-abiding citizens, but once you're no longer the law-abiding citizen, once you're violating the rules, once you're already drunk driving, and that's what they're saying. They're saying, we don't want people who are getting this real-time notification to be able to get GPS information. My question is, if we can get that once they're no longer law-abiding, if this statute would allow that to happen, that's all.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments for this testifier? Don, thank you for your testimony, sir. Next up is Ms. Gina Calistri. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. I am Gina Calistri. You were close. thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify here today. My name, again, is Gina Calistri. I am the chair of MAD Minnesota's Public Policy Committee. I lost my father, Mike Calistri, who had just retired from the Minneapolis Police Department after 35 years of service on Easter Sunday 2010 to a repeat drunk driver who had been ordered to install ignition interlock device but failed to do so. My mother, also involved in the crash, survived life-threatening injuries. She has faced years of physical therapy around her injuries, but more painful was the heartbreak of losing my father, her childhood sweetheart. To remind the committee, every day in this country, 28 people are killed, and every 2 minutes, someone is injured in a drunk driving crash. Over the last 5 years in Minnesota, 508 people have lost their life in alcohol-impaired, .08 or higher, crashes in our state. More than 10,000 were injured. In 2015 alone, There were 107 deaths, the highest number of alcohol-impaired fatalities since 2011. That means that not even 3 days pass every week, and some Minnesota family must deal with the tragic and wholly preventable death of a loved one. Six families a day must deal with the devastating injuries sustained by family members in these same crashes. Since 2011, offenders in the Ignition Interlock Program in Minnesota have logged 33,539 failed rolling retests. 1,282 of them are over .08. Matt is committed to using technology to stop drunk driving. It benefits the safety of the public and of the offender using the technology. I don't need to spend time discussing the voluminous scientific support that exists for the efficacy of ignition interlocks, because I think we all can agree here this morning that the technology does stop drunk driving. With respect to the bill before you, Matt understands the concerns about data privacy. Data privacy is an issue that is important for all citizens in every area of our lives. However, Matt is confused about the concern of this committee when it comes to the interlocks and data privacy, and fully supports the Minnesota Department of Public Safety and real-time reporting for ignition interlock offenders. According to statements from the DPS in our research, DPS does not collect GPS data from interlock vendors or offenders. Real-time reporting is not the same as GPS, and it should at all costs be preserved. Other than being the authority that certifies ignition interlock devices as suitable for use in our state, Minnesota DPS does not have a business or contractual relationship with any interlock provider or manufacturer. There is no legal way for someone with nefarious intent to request or demand private data for the interlock provider via the authority of the DPS. The only legal relationship with interlock providers is that of a private contract between the offender and the interlock provider. Offenders are made aware of the data collected and agree to its collection in exchange for the ability to drive legally and without restriction to work, school, treatment, and to care for their families. Real-time reporting only comes into play, like mentioned, if offenders are not following the rules they agreed to in exchange for unlimited legal driving privileges. If offenders are still trying to drink and drive, real-time reporting offers DPS a chance to intervene sooner and prevent drunk driving tragedies that endanger all Minnesota motorists. Real-time reporting offers a real benefit to offenders as well, cutting in half the number of times they must physically report to the interlock provider to calibrate their device, saving the offender significant time and resources. This is a win-win situation for everyone. I would like to know who exactly has been harmed by ignition interlock GPS. This feels like a solution looking for a problem, because I can start naming real people who have been hurt or killed by drunk drivers. Hypothetical victims should not outweigh real people who have suffered real harms. This includes innocent children. In 2014, 1,070 children were killed in traffic crashes. 19% of them were killed in alcohol-impaired driving crashes. 116 of those 209, which is over half, were passengers of vehicles with alcohol-impaired drivers. The story you heard from the vendor is just one of the many situations that we hear about at MAD where innocent children are placed in harm's way in the hand of their trusted adults. Minnesota DPS has worked hard to improve the interlock program in Minnesota and has tried to implement national best practices and improvements to make interlock program as effective as possible. MAD suggests this committee review the excellent new DPS publication entitled Minnesota Ignition Interlock Program Evaluation Final Report. It was completed in late 2016. It reviews the Minnesota Interlock Program and its outcomes. It concludes that interlocks are significantly reducing recidivism for Minnesota offenders and makes specific recommendations to further improve interlock use and effectiveness, including mandating interlocks for all DWI offenders. Just yesterday, the National Safety Council published the motor vehicle that motor vehicle deaths in 2016 are estimated to be the highest in 9 years. The NSC is calling for immediate implementation of life-saving measures that would set the nation on a road to zero deaths. The absolute first recommendation is to mandate ignition interlocks for convicted drunk drivers. MAD strongly supports these recommendations and intends to bring legislation forward to the House in consideration in the near future. This would take care of any concerns about offenders opting out of this life-saving interlock program, like the man that killed my father. I'm here before you today as a voice for drunk driving victims, past and future, who depend on you to do your part in preventing these wholly preventable, avoidable tragedies. We count on you to strongly encourage the use of effective strategies like real-time reporting that enhance the use of life-saving interlock technology, weighing the safety of Minnesota motorists as paramount over all these issues. Thank you to all those committee members that acknowledge the violent crime of drunk driving and to continue to support our efforts.
Any questions or comments for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Representative Lesh.
Thank you. I may have a question for the testifier based on her testimony, but I'm assuming we're probably going to hear from DPS.
Representative Lesh, they will be asked next if they wish to have any comments for the record.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Is the department here, and do they care to testify? Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Don Olson, and I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety. I'm not here today prepared for testimony. I can take questions if there's any questions at the committee.
Thank you. Representative Letch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So last time the department was here, I think there was some confusion regarding whether the department believed this information was available without a data classification. And that confusion, I think, was reflected in the statement from the individual who tested on behalf of MAD, maintaining that because this information was retained by the companies, that it was not public data. I had also heard a rumor, I can't remember where I heard it, that the department was going to request an advisory opinion from IPAD on that or something. What is the department's position on that now? What is the status of your request for an advisory opinion? Have you consulted any legal counsel to help you determine the status of that data?
Ms. Olson.
I'm going to have Deputy Commissioner O'Hearn respond to that question.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Cassandra O'Hearn. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. With respect to Representative's question about whether the department has sought advice about the classification, the department has requested an advisory opinion from the Department of Administration's IPAD. We have been notified that due to pending litigation, they're not going to provide that opinion at this time.
Okay.
Representative Lutz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So then, Ms. Orker, in the absence of that, what is the department's current position on the status of the data?
Ms. O'Hearn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, at this time, the advice that we have received is currently that information is not government data because the department does not maintain it, and the department does not have a contractual relationship with the manufacturers.
Okay.
Representative Lutz.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And is it Ms. O'Hearn?
That's correct.
Okay, Ms. O'Hearn. So who'd you get that advice from?
Ms. O'Hearn.
That advice has come from our general counsel.
Representative Lutz.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Chair. Ms. O'Hearn, trying not to sound snotty, but I would advise your general counsel to read current case law that has been before the Court of Appeals on this, and I'd be fascinated to hear how your general counsel has arrived at that opinion, because if you are conducting a government function, you cannot mask or hide data by outsourcing it or contracting it out. You can't. It's the Data Practices Act, so I'd love to be proven wrong on that in some way. But this is our point. Just because you assert that that's not available, and so victims of crimes or people who avail themselves of the benefits of programs that we have, like Safe at Home, they should not be able to be discovered because we failed to classify data in a proper way. So whatever the case, I'd love to hear from your general counsel, and if they prepare a memo for you or something on that, I'd love to read it. If I can be proven wrong, I'm completely open to that.
Ms. Hearn, comment?
Well, I will provide a comment, and we can certainly talk offline as well. I believe the court case that you're referring to is the Timber Jay. In that case, the relationship is a contractual relationship. There is no contractual relationship between a state government, the department in this case, with the manufacturers. That is just a totally different situation. However, it is obviously for the legislature to determine any classification and certainly could do so differently.
Representative Rush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. O'Hearn, I think I get that the hook upon which you're hanging your hat is contractual relationship. That is not the pivotal determiner in the law. It's whether you are providing a government function. That is where the law turns on this. So I would still like to see the memo, but the point here is that we're creating law here for the courts to follow. So even if the courts were to determine that contractual relationship was the pivot on which this thing turns, it's the legislature's job to say, wow, it's certainly not appropriate, even if the court decides that you can dodge Chapter 13 by contracting this out, we will change the law. So if that's how you're treating it, the legislature can then appropriately say, well, listen, we have an obligation to people's data privacy as well. So that's all I have to say about that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. O'Hearn, is your general counsel here today able to testify?
Our general counsel is not present today.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Yes, Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, I was taking notes as the testifier for MAD was speaking, but perhaps Ms. O'Hearn, you can help me with this. There was a comment made in terms of GPS tracking versus real-time tracking and that there was a distinction made there. Would you be able to speak to that and tell me what the difference is between those two?
Ms. O'Hearn.
Thank you. Representative, yes, I can. I cannot speak to the actual behind-the-scenes technology, but the department in the certification requirements for 2016, those that have come before here, required real-time reporting. And that is that the device provides information directly from the device to the manufacturer. Okay? Because currently, without real-time reporting, the only time that information from the machine is read or available is when that customer comes in for their monthly calibration. Then it downloads all the information that has been stored on the machine for the past 30 days. Real-time reporting, in contrast, allows the machine to immediately say, yes, there has been a violation. That information goes to the manufacturer, okay? Because the contractual relationship is between the customer and that manufacturer. Now, GPS technology, which was not required under this certification, has not been required or used by the Department of Public Safety at any time. Our understanding is that some of the manufacturers, in the way that real time, the technology kind of behind the scenes, also had location tracking ability. I am not aware that any manufacturer was actually watching the tracking of movement, but there are manufacturers present in the room and they would have to speak to that.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's very helpful in terms of making that distinction between, again, this, I think what was referred to as an opportunity for a win-win, in distinguishing between the real-time reporting and the GPS or location tracking. And that, obviously, where there's a situation where a drunk driver is operating a vehicle while intoxicated, time is essentially of the essence in terms of bringing that person to justice and making sure that they're no longer on the street. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that explanation.
Any other questions or comments for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there any testimony from anyone in the audience? Yes. Please come forward. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Ken Denton. I am with LifeSafer Interlock, and as the compliance manager for the company.
I appreciate the time to speak with you today. I was able to speak with Representative Scott on the telephone the other day and answer some of her questions. And I wanted to come today to not only provide our support for DDS and this committee, as well as all the state citizens of Minnesota. We are willing to do whatever this committee decides to do, whatever the law decides to do. However, we do have concerns about the liability that may be upon us as a manufacturer for maintaining this data. We would ask that whatever bill is decided, if it has real-time or GPS, that there be some protections built into place that would allow for rule writing, rulemaking, or legislation that protects us and tells us how to maintain such data. I also am happy to answer any questions. I will say that I came from the state of Washington, where I ran the program in the state of Washington for many years. I retired about a year and a half ago, and in Washington State, we do have GPS tracking. We do not have real-time reporting. And the reason that we have that GPS tracking is so that, is the reason we came up with that GPS tracking, rather, is when I first put cameras into vehicles, or when we were first required cameras into vehicles, we had multiple situations where a photograph was provided of a failed breath sample, and then a follow-up pass test with a child blowing into the device, and then the person driving off. There was no way for us to charge that individual with circumvention of the interlock device because we could not prove where that violation had occurred. It needed to occur on Washington State soil. If there's use of GPS technology, I applaud it. It's good technology if it's used for the purpose that it's needed to be used for. We vote a law stating that it would be utilized for circumvention cases and to try and prevent circumvention and tampering cases such as the one I mentioned to you today. Real-time reporting and GPS for us, and I can't speak for all of my colleagues, but for us, they are separate items. They are real-time, as the director mentioned earlier, real-time reporting is the ability through cellular technology to upload the data immediately to our systems. Once a violation or pass, for that matter, has occurred, we can see that in real time as soon as cellular connectivity allows for it to do so. We do have our GPS turned off on our device. We are not tracking anyone, but we do have the real-time reporting on so that we can provide that information to the Department of Vehicle Safety Services, as needed.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would your technology allow you, in the event that there was a strong violation, maybe a real high blow reading, to turn that GPS on to find out where that person was at the time?
Mr. Denton.
No, not immediately. It would need to come in for service where we would activate that GPS technology, and then it would go back out into the field with that GPS activity activated.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thanks.
Anyone else from the audience wish to testify this morning? Seeing none. Any other questions or comments to this bill from the committee? Seeing none, Representative Scott.
Just thank you for your consideration of this bill. And I wanted to address just real quickly the data classification. And we didn't choose to put any data classification in this bill because we knew that the department had asked for an advisory opinion on that. And that's still under investigation. And so I'm certainly open to making a change in that regard. But otherwise, I just appreciate your support.
Representative Scott renews her motion for House file. Representative Hillstrom, this bill is going to be recommended and re-referred to the Public Safety, Security, Policy, and Finance. With that said, Representative Scott renews her motion for House File 179 to be recommended and re-referred as amended to Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. This committee stands in recess until 9:15 or the call of the chair.
call the meeting back to order. Thank you for your patience. Representative Knobloch is not in the building yet. He had a previous engagement this morning. I thought he might be here, but we decided if at 9:15 he wasn't, then Representative Vogel would come and present his bill. And we do have a lot of testifiers here this morning, and we have, 45 minutes roughly left in committee time? An hour.
Oh,
45 minutes. And so we'll limit testimony to 2 minutes. And for those of you coming forward to testimony, if you could keep your comments to something that hasn't already been expressed on this bill, that would be great. So with that, Representative Vogel, would you like to move House File 923? And the recommendation is that it be referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, I would like to move House File 923.
Thank you. Go ahead with your comments.
House File 923 requires the court to consider the reasonableness of attorney's fees sought in relation to the amount of damages awarded, and also the reasonableness of the award compared to the amount sought and awarded. Additionally, attorney's fees would also be capped at the point which the prevailing party turned down the settlement offer if that offer was as much as or more than awarded at the trial.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Thank you for pinch hitting, by the way. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Representative Vogel, I'm sorry that these questions were originally designed for Representative Knobloch, but what about equitable relief? Oh, Representative Knobloch is here, so he's going to want to answer
the
question.
You're off the hook.
Thank you, Bob.
I'll let you have the other.
He's handing the baton over. Yeah, thank you. Representative Knobloch, just to get you up to date, Bob, Representative Vogel just presented your bill and the comments on the bill, and Representative Hillstrom has a question.
So, Madam Chair, I would let Representative Knobloch say whatever it is he wanted to say about his bill and then give him the opportunity.
Okay, sure. Representative Knobloch, if you want to make comments on your bill, and then she'll ask the question.
All right. Well, sorry, I am late. As I know, I told the chair and a few members, I had a meeting with the governor and some other members this morning, and so I just got back from that. I'm sure Representative Vogel's already told you the main parts of the bill, but I want to say that this bill was spurred by a situation we had in St. Cloud some years ago. Our St. Cloud Public Library had a dispute with an employee who sued them underneath one of the statutes in which attorney's fees would be required to be paid by the defendant if the plaintiff prevailed. It was seen as the sort of lawsuit in which the library had some fault but would not likely be very much in terms of damages. There was, as I recall, and again, this is some years ago, so my recollection is a little dim, but there was, I believe, an offer of settlement in the range of $10,000 early on. That was not accepted, even though I think a lot of people felt it was something that was probably where they might end up in the end. The case went all the way through trial. When the judgment was finally awarded, there was, in fact, a $10,000 judgment, but the attorneys were awarded $91,000 in attorney fees, which my local library then had to pay. And what this bill is trying to get at is to encourage settlement early on instead of encouraging a situation where it might be in the attorney's case to bring a case all the way through trial and rack up then significant attorney fees that the defendant, in this case the St. Cloud Public Library, would have to pay. And so that was really the original spur to this case for me. I note that if Representative Vogel hadn't said it, that in addition to a number of business groups, this bill is supported by the League of Minnesota Cities, who have experienced situations like this in the past. And so that's the motivation for this bill, and I would appreciate people's support.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Knobloch, what about some of the equitable items that people might sue for? You want redress, or maybe you want a negative review taken out of your personnel file, or maybe you want some other kind of equitable result from the court that you can't negotiate. This would say that money is the only thing that matters in a lawsuit, and I clearly think we have a lot of lawsuits for a lot of reasons other than just money.
Representative Knobloch.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, certainly that's the case. Certainly this would deal with money-type issues. You know, what I'd like to do, Madam Chair, is we have some testifiers here, and I know one, Tom Marshall, an attorney who's dealt at length with these and is not always available, is here, and I'm wondering if he could come down and provide some additional testimony and maybe help Representative Hillstrom with a more detailed answer to that question.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Marshall. Thanks for being here. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tom Marshall. I'm an attorney who practices in Minneapolis. I'm also a past president of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm a certified specialist in the area of employment law by the Minnesota State Bar Association as well. And I'd like to respond to your question first, because it raised an interesting thing. In our employment laws, a person can't sue to have something taken out of their file. There's a process for dealing with that, and now in 2008 our Supreme Court changed our Rule 68 procedure, which allowed a person to make a request for equitable relief in Rule 68, and now they can. And that's a rule change that's there, and you could do that in the federal system. But now our system is set up so it deals strictly with money, unfortunately, and that's the problem we have here. We can't deal with equitable relief. And what we're trying to do with this bill on the attorney fee provision especially is to deal with a situation where you have a defendant who makes a reasonable offer of settlement in a case where there's fee shifting, meaning that the loser pays the other side's fees, which isn't our system in most cases, personal injury cases, for example. And when that other side is ordered to pay fees at the end of the case, they made a reasonable offer of settlement. For example, in the case that Representative Knobloch was talking about in St. Cloud, this person requested reinstatement in their position, and the offer of settlement was not $10,000. It was $155,000. A lot of money. And that person got far less than that at the end of the case. And had this case been in federal court where an offer of judgment was made under their Rule 68, a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court would say that after that offer was made and the plaintiff did so poorly against the offer, we're not going to make that library pay attorney's fees after that library made this generous offer to try to resolve the case. Instead, what the judge did in that case, he said, well, you know, I guess they did make a good offer, so I'm only going to make them pay half of those fees incurred after that point, which is still a lot of money for nothing. And then the case that was in the U.S. Supreme Court, Merrick versus Chesney, talked about, in that case, an offer of judgment was made by the defendant. The plaintiff ultimately did $8,000 less than that offer of judgment that was made, yet the plaintiff attorneys incurred over $140,000 in fees after that offer was made. And the court said, it's just not fair to make a defendant pay for that when it added nothing to the case. And that's the situation that the library found itself in St. Cloud. That's the situation we find ourselves in many cases now. Now with our present Rule 68, if a defendant makes a generous offer of settlement through an offer of judgment, it has no effect on the attorney's fees and provides an incentive to keep the case going. Yes.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the case that you're citing as the example for why we need this law change, there was no other relief granted by the court except the dollar amount. Is that what your testimony is?
Mr. Marshall.
Representative, I'm sorry.
Hillstrom.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, I believe the case in St. Cloud, they did award some monetary amount, but I think it was like $10,000, so I don't have the exact amount in my head.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the question was, what else did they order? I understand that now maybe the rules are saying that it's about money, but it's my understanding through that case, I'm a lawyer as well, so it's my understanding through that case that there actually was some other relief that was granted, and this statute would actually prohibit or make it so that if you're going for something other than just the money, that you would not be able to get that equitable relief. The governor vetoed this bill, this exact bill, February 10th of 2012. And in the governor's veto letter, he said that this legislation negatively impact the people negatively impacted by this legislation would be deployed military personnel, farmers, vulnerable adults, and victims of workplace harassment, wrongful termination, and discrimination are the few of the classes of individuals that would be harmed by this legislation. So my question for you is, if we're just talking about money, why would the governor say that those folks who we spend a lot of time here in the legislature trying to protect would be negatively impacted by this statute?
Mr. Marshall?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. I don't know what the governor's motivation was for saying those things, but the way our current Rule 68 exists, and this has nothing to do with the case law, the way our current Rule 68 exists, it provides for damages-only offers and amounts. Rule 68 doesn't deal with equitable relief the way it's currently couched in our system. So while a person who's making a claim for relief under, let's say, Human Rights Act, there's various forms of relief. The most typical one that some people consider equitable relief is the request for reinstatement. And reinstatement, I think, is also what maybe the person in St. Paul get. I don't recall specifically. But a claim for reinstatement can also be monetized in the sense of front pay, what's it worth. So in the sense of certain equitable relief, I think the statute would apply, because a person could make a claim for reinstatement under the Human Rights Act, and the person could make an offer of judgment. The defendant, unfortunately, is faced with a situation where we can only make an offer in monetary terms. And, frankly, the statute or the current rule applies to plaintiffs as well. They can make an offer, but in monetary terms, which is the constraints of the current rule.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the court can't then order reinstatement of the position as part of the relief? And if the court did order reinstatement as part of the relief, wouldn't this statute say, even if you won that order from the court, that then you can't get the monetary, you can't get your attorney's fees paid if the amount of money that you got was less than the offer?
Mr. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. No, I disagree with that completely. A court, you're confusing the Rule 68 with the claims made by the plaintiff in the lawsuit. A plaintiff can claim reinstatement and get awarded reinstatement. We're talking about the operation of Rule 68 and what, and the attorney fee shifting provision in that. And the way the statute is written, the first half of the statute looks at what is the result. You look at it in terms of result, but it also says it's only one factor. There are many factors that are considered in when the court awards attorney fees at the end of the case. The degree to which it's defended. If the defendant decides to do a scorched earth issue, and this is separate and apart from Rule 68. This is separate and apart from the second half of the statute. The court can look at that and say, no, we're going to award fees for that that conduct. Or we're going to award fees because of the unusual complexity of the case. Or we're going to award fees for other reasons as well as just the result. The result is just one factor to be considered, not the only factor.
Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So how is that different then from the current practice and the judge's ability to say that he was going to only order 50% of the attorney's fees?
Mr. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom. I guess I'm not sure what your question is. The court has discretion to look at the fee petition by the plaintiff at the end of the case. And the court can look at all these factors that are considered. I think the main federal case on that is used by Minnesota courts as well. It's called Hensley versus Eckert or Eckerhart, and there's numerous factors that a court can consider. And I can speak from this from personal experience. I mean, I represent employees as well as employers. And we recently received a $2.2 million fee award in a case in federal court a year or two ago where our client recovered about $200,000 in damage, made a little more. Now, some people would say, wow, that's not great. That's crazy in regard to he only got $200,000. But we went through 4 years of litigation. We were fought every step of the way. There was no Rule 68 offer of judgment that was brought here. And the court felt that the way that the defendant looked at it, and cases Ewald versus Norway, the opinion is quite well-written, describes all the factors that a court's considered. So a court has plenty of discretion to do that, and even under the statute, it still has discretion to do that. The first half deals with issues of looking at what's the result obtained in addition to the other factors. The second half looks at just the Rule 68 offer judgment, because if in our case, where we represented our client in an equal pay claim against Norway, had Norway decided to make an offer of judgment saying, okay, we have paid you $30,000 a year less than the mail for the last 3 years, we're offering you $100,000 plus your attorney's fees to date, he would be hard-pressed to turn that offer down. It was never made. So what this statute does is it encourages settlement, because now we have a situation where, especially in fee situation cases, no one cares. The defendants don't use it because it's worthless. And if the committee is looking at ways to try to encourage resolution, try to encourage settlement in a fair way, and what our organization does, the Defense Lawyers Association, is try to create a level playing field. There isn't a level playing field here. And if we want to have fairness and have people seriously consider settlement offers in ways to, like, look, hey, this is pretty fair, we should look at this seriously, and if we don't look at it, there's some risk involved if we don't agree to accept it. But right now there's no risk, because if a settlement offer is made in a fee-shifting case, it has absolutely no effects on the fees. So no one uses it, and it's a procedure that exists without a purpose.
And if I could interject, this isn't a radical proposal. If I understand it correctly, this is basically what the federal rules are right now. Is that not right, Mr. Marshall?
Mr. Marshall?
Right. Madam Chair, that's true. The Federal Rule 68 has been existed for 78 years, and the case of Merrick versus Chesano, I think it goes back to the 70s, has been the practice there, and it's worked very well. And, you know, for example, I told my assistant that I'm coming down here this morning, and she was looking at the Rule 68. She goes, hey, you know, we used to do these a lot. We don't do these anymore. It's like, well, because it doesn't work. And why do you think so many employment cases in this state are, if possible, removed to federal court? Because our procedure isn't fair.
Just one last question.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Knobloch, what have you done to the proposal since February 10th of 2012 to put it in a position that the governor might even consider it, given that he's already vetoed this bill once?
Representative Knobloch.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I guess I wasn't here in, did you say it was 2010 that the governor vetoed it?
2012.
2012, excuse me. I guess I wasn't here in 2012. The proposal is, and I guess I don't know, I know the governor had vetoed this or something similar to this. I guess I don't know if there's any difference in this from what the governor vetoed. I don't think there really is, but I would also say, when I listen to what the governor's veto message was, you know, I don't really think that, with all due respect to the governor, who I know and like, that he perhaps completely was aware of all the ramifications of the veto and why it actually would have made sense to sign the bill. And I guess I would hope that I'd be able to give him a better argument than whoever the author was of the bill back then.
The next testifier I have on the agenda is Mike Hickey. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Lunin has a question for this.
Thank you, Madam. To Mr. Marshall. So this bill, you know, I'm looking at the Rule of 68 here, and when a case continues, there's obviously the meter running on legal fees, but there's also court costs. I'm a plaintiff in a case, and I want to hire an expert witness to come in and testify. All of those things ratchet up court costs as well. This bill does not affect a plaintiff's capability of going forward and still utilizing any possible resources they could under the advice of their attorney. Those still would be owable if the defendant lost. Would that be correct?
Mr. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative. Certainly. I mean, a prevailing party is entitled to their costs. What Rule 68 does is, in the situation now, I mean, under the present situation, if a defendant makes an offer of settlement under Rule 68, and they have two types, they have a damages-only offer and a total obligation offer. But if a person makes an offer of settlement, let's say you have your client and you're going to trial, and And more than 10 days before trial, the defendant decides to utilize our procedure and makes an offer of settlement, let's say $50,000. And you go through trial and you get fees on it. You can have a fee claim for it. What happened is that the court, and you hire your expert after this offer of settlement is made, and you go to trial, and let's say you do $45,000. The court could award you your costs up to the point of the offer, but then the defendant would be awarded, you would not be allowed to make your claim for costs after the offer was made. However, your attorney's fees would still continue. So, in one sense, the lawyer benefits, but the client does. So, I mean, that's the result. Now, the other thing is under our system, is that if, and what people are doing now to defendants, is that a plaintiff will make an offer of judgment immediately for some exorbitant amount of money. And of course, the defendant doesn't respond because we have 10 days to respond. And then what happens at the end of it, the way our Rule 68 is, they can claim double costs, and the defendant pays their own costs, which is, you know, seems unfair, so they get a reward for making an exorbitant amount of costs that a defendant can't respond
to. Representative Lunin?
Just for clarification, that's if the settlement ends up being higher than what the defendant ultimately ends up offering, then you go into a double recovery for, and that's just the court cost. This bill is just about the legal fees of the attorney who would be advising a plaintiff to continue or go forward or not continue to go forward. Basically, it's putting into play the fee that attorney is charging for that advice.
Mr. Marshall.
Yes, basically that's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Peake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Marshall, I'm not an attorney. I'm okay with that. And thank you. And my question is you've talked about this notion of there's no risk, and I would assume that if I was a plaintiff's attorney and I was advising my client not to settle, and I proceeded down the road of continuing through a trial, and I lost, I think there would be huge risk for me because I would lose virtually any of my ability to get fee, and now my client might be responsible for other fees. So if you could just sort of help me understand that from a lawyer's point of view.
Sure.
Mr. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative, the presently, the way it works is that, let's say the defendant makes an offer of judgment under Rule 68 for $50,000. There's risk to the client in the sense of, okay, if we incur additional costs after this offer, I might have to be responsible for those. As to the attorney's fees, there's no effect whatsoever because the Rule 68 says there's no effect whatsoever. So as to the attorney, there's no risk at all. Now, under the bill, what would happen is that if I made an offer judgment for $50,000 and the case is, that's a fair value for the case and the attorney's fees to that point in time, and the case continues, well, then there is risk as to whether or not you would get your fee after that point in time, and you'd have to make a decision there. And the fact is your fee would be the responsibility of your client, not you. Now, as far as when you say exposed to other fees, our human rights statute, for example, provides that a prevailing party may get fees, and that includes the defendant could be a prevailing party. I have never seen in now my 33 years of practice, the majority of which being representing parties in civil disputes involving attorney's fees and employment law situations, a situation where a defendant was awarded attorney's fees as a prevailing party, ever. And as a matter of fact, the court in Sigurdsson versus Isani County has said that in order for a defendant to get a fee, they have to demonstrate that the plaintiff's claim was frivolous, not justified under the law. So it doesn't happen. The risk of getting fees in practicality by the defendant against the plaintiff, unless it's a completely frivolous and obnoxious case, is non-existent.
Representative Dean?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then my question would be to the bill author. So why doesn't this bill make it so that defendants can cover those fees in these cases?
Representative Knobloch.
Sir, can you repeat that question, Representative Dean?
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as Mr. Marshall, right?
Mr. Marshall, yes.
Marshall, just stated that defendants in these cases never recover, or virtually in all of his years doing this business, don't recover the fees for some reason. And my question to you is, why isn't this bill that you have, instead of saying that, you know, at this point there's no recovering of fees forward, why doesn't it go the other direction and say that should a defendant win, that then the plaintiff would be responsible for paying those legal fees of the prevailing party, which is, I think that's kind of what we've been talking about here. Now, attorneys in the room, you might be pissed at me for asking this question, but I think it's an appropriate question.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I guess, first of all, this conforms with the way the Federal Rule 68 is done. And that's part of the, and frankly, the way that we used to do it in Minnesota going back some years ago. I think that, and I guess Mr. Marshall could correct me on this, I think that that would still be possible, but I think what Mr. Marshall is saying is just in practicality, the defendants are never awarded fees.
Members, we need to get on with our other testifiers. We have to be out of here by 10 for the Rules Committee to meet. So if we could get down our list of testifiers and then answer questions. And we are going to hold you to a strict 2 minutes for the remainder of the testifiers. Mike Hickey. And on deck is Ron Elwood, and after him, Josh Newville. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Madam Chair, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business, and thank you for spending the time on this important issue today. I represent National Federation of Independent Business. I'm also speaking for the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform and the many, many members we have, and we have a handout and a list of them in your packet, as you've seen. Tom Marshall said it best. I just wanted to follow up with a couple brief comments. We have a lot of fee shift statutes. We have over 400 of them based on a report I saw from House Research, and that was a while ago. Might have some more, unfortunately, have been added. And our fee shift really doesn't work in this state. It's a one-way fee shift. As Mr. Marshall mentioned, we have controlling U.S. and state Supreme Court decisions. It's extremely rare that a small business, a city, a county would ever get their fees. And the case would have to be a pretty terrible case, and it's just not happening. And so there's a real inequity here. Representative Dean, we'd love to have some kind of a modified loser pay here. It's when you look at how many lawsuits are filed against small business and against government. That's why League of Cities supports this bill. But in the political environment we are here today, I think this is the best we can do, is to try to discipline this offer of settlement process, get close to what the conforming really to what the federal does under Rule 68. And when you look at how many settlements we have, our system's very settlement-driven. We really need this. And we have over 400 fee shift statutes. We really need this. So I want to thank Representative Knobloch for revisiting this issue. He brought it to everyone's attention way back in his first term, and we're still talking about it, but it's a really important issue.
Thank you. Mr. Elwood. And after Josh Newville, we have Mark Heaney. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. You know, it's never a comfortable position for me to be in, to be testifying against any legislator's bill, especially the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. So I guess that ask I was going to make of you was toast now, I assume. But
No.
But seriously, I want to just with respect to both Representative Knobloch, Chair Knobloch, and also the proponents, we are here today to speak in opposition to House File 923, and I want to just briefly articulate the reasons. First and foremost, the Minnesotans that this bill will hurt the most are lower income, lower wage, financially and mentally vulnerable folks, older Minnesotans, and Minnesotans with disabilities. And the reason for that is, and I know that, first of all, that cannot be the intent of the author or the proponents of this bill or anybody here. But it would hurt them because enactment of this legislation would produce a very perverse result. It would actually foster scams and reward scam artists. So, for example, in the loan mod scams that we've dealt with here for years, the scam artists typically bilk about $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 from the victims. And many of those are clients of the older homeowners. So because of the small amount of the damages sought and obtained, this bill would effectively prevent private attorneys from taking those cases. So in that sense, it would be a very, very harmful result. Representative Hillstrom already noted the fact that the equitable relief problem exists. And third, the bill is unnecessary. As has been discussed, the rules of civil procedure already require consideration of the very factors that are contained in this bill. Consideration of proportionality, as this is called, has already been upheld by the Minnesota Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court. In the city of Riverside versus Rivera, the United States Supreme Court said, quote, "The amount of damages the plaintiff recovers is certainly relevant to the amount of the attorney's fees to be rewarded." This is already law. The Minnesota Supreme Court in 86 and 2013 said the same thing. Thank you very much. Happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Josh Newville, and after him, Mark Heaney, and then Steve Smith. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, my name is Josh Newville. I'm a civil rights and employment attorney at Medea Law in Minneapolis. I represent victims of discrimination and unfair treatment. I am here today to speak in opposition to this bill. I will start by saying that last night I did an analysis of our last 100 clients in both employment and civil rights matters, and I looked at their total income, and 97 of those individuals made less than $100,000. 97. Of those individuals, 17 received offers of judgment. There's been some testimony here today from the bill's proponents that offers of judgment aren't used. That's simply false. They are used, and they are used sometimes with great effect. We have to deal with these. They can have significant implications on our clients' cases. We talk seriously with them, and the truth of the matter is we have taken them. We've accepted them here and there. There are times when, you know, when we reject them, and we do so with an abundance of caution. The passing of this bill would have a tremendous impact on these individuals who are put out of their jobs for discriminatory reasons, individuals who are treated discriminatorily because of everything from race to disability to, you know, a host of other issues in public accommodations, to individuals who interact with government officials and have their civil rights deprived. It would make it very, very difficult. And it's interesting that the proponents argue that the current system offers or incentivizes attorneys to put their interests ahead of their clients. Not only do I disagree with that, but think about the implications of this bill if it passes. It actually incentivizes attorneys to put their interests ahead of their clients in a real fundamental way, because it says that if this is a low damages case and, you know, there's a low offer that came in, well, I mean, all the incentive in the world to settle this thing out for, you know, some nuisance value rather than actually, you know, take it through to, you know, get this individual what they deserve. And so, you know, what I would ask, and I see my time is up, so I'll just conclude by saying, if there was an attempt to circumvent the Minnesota Human Rights Act and other laws that prohibit discrimination and retaliation, other than directly overturning it, I can't imagine a bill that would be much different than this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Mark Heaney. We're gonna wait till after. Mr. Heaney, please introduce yourself for the tape.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representatives. My name is Mark Heaney. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Minnesota. The majority of my clients are individuals who have suffered violations of Minnesota and federal consumer protection statutes. I'm here today to testify in opposition to this bill. By way of example, which I think would be most helpful, over the last number of years, I have represented individuals who have been victims of payday loans. Your payday loan statute, 47.60 here in the state of Minnesota, puts caps on the amount of interest that a payday lender can charge consumers. It also and it has a recovery of statutory damages, actual damages, what the person paid in interest above and beyond, and then it also has an attorney fee shifting provision. I've got a number of calls and represented people who have been ripped off by payday loans with interest exceeding 1,200%. Often, we will litigate those cases against the largest law firms in Minnesota who put up a fight in defending these predatory lenders. The reason I'm able to represent these individuals is because of the fact that these predatory lenders have to pay the attorney's fees at the end of the day if they don't make good and return the interest that they've illegally gained. If you take away and use this proportionality, and this bill elevates proportionality above all the other factors that a judge already has to take into consideration now when determining attorney's fees, If you do that, it will make it in. If we recover $500 of interest that has been paid to a predatory lender, and a court has to look at that and say, well, you got $500 back. You may have spent 100 hours going to battle with the biggest law firms in Minnesota to get that money back. But nonetheless, because of this proportionality rule that the legislature said, now we can only pay you $500. I do a lot of pro bono work, but our practices will not be able to continue to represent low-income individuals on what amounts to less than minimum wage, ultimately. So thank you.
Steve Smith, Adriana Shannon, and Adam Strauss. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Stephen Andrew Smith. I'm a partner in Nichols Castor in Minneapolis, where we represent employees in civil rights cases. I think HF 923 is contrary to the policy objectives of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which state that the objective of that statute is to eliminate discrimination in the workplace in particular. A little bit of background. We take about 4 or 5% of the cases that come in, so we take a very small percentage of civil rights and discrimination cases because they're very difficult to win. We will be able to take far less than that, and it'll be a decrease in sort of justice in the employment setting relating to employment discrimination, because these cases and the policy objectives and the legislative history and the Human Rights Act talks about, these are cases involving small damages, but big policy issues. We want to eliminate discrimination in the workplace, and some of those cases involve small damages. And so we need to make sure that there's equitable relief. The testimony previous on that was inconsistent with the Human Rights Act. Equitable relief is available. Treble damages are available. Reinstatement is available, and civil penalties are available. So there's all kinds of relief that doesn't necessarily involve lost wages or emotional distress. One important thing to note in the last year in terms of the calls that we've received a substantial increase in calls in this sort of post Make America Great Again time period that we're in right now. And that is a big deal in a couple respects. Is people now feel for some reason like it's okay to let their inner racist out, and so we're seeing calls, increased discrimination calls, increased religious discrimination calls, increased gender discrimination calls. Those cases involve small damages, and we want to continue to take those cases. Mr. Marshall testified earlier today about his case, and I want to talk specifically about proportionality. I was the fee expert retained by Mr. Marshall's firm in that case to talk about the reasonableness of the fees. They got a $2 million fee award because the defendants were outrageous in the way that they litigated that case. That's a big deal. If you say proportionality is all that matters, then a defendant can fight as long as they want for as many years as they want, and there'll be no real consequence to that. And so that proportionality test it can't possibly stand.
Thank you, Adriana Shannon, Adam Strauss, and Carrie Franzen. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Adriana Shannon. I am in private practice. The majority of my practice involves representing plaintiffs in civil rights and employment matters. Much of our practice relies on contingency fee agreements where the attorney actually isn't paid unless the person wins, and then it's just a proportion of whatever the person recovers. That is not typically the case on the defense side. So these are two very different. You were asking questions earlier about why isn't this applicable to the defense side. The fee situation is entirely different. The way that impacts our practice is that when we have a contingency fee case and we have a situation that comes up, for example, a minimum wage or overtime case where you have a very low income earner, you have a vulnerable adult, for example, who is perhaps mentally retarded, someone who has disabilities who only can do low-income jobs, those people will not be able to hire an attorney because they don't have the money to pay an attorney, and no attorney is going to accept that file on a contingency fee if the attorney's fees are not recoverable. It will absolutely eviscerate the ability of people who are the most marginalized to be able to access the court system and to be able to access their rights. The people who are protected in the fee-shifting context are the very same people that are victimized under this bill. We've heard a lot of discussion today about Rule 68 and how Rule 68 in Minnesota doesn't work and how we should pass this bill because Rule 68 needs revision. This is not a bill to amend Rule 68. If you want to amend Rule 68, do it the correct way. This is not the appropriate venue. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. Our last testifier today will be Adam Strauss. The chair's intent is to lay the bill over and finish up with it next week. Adam Strauss, you are the last testifier. You don't have to show up again next week. It's lucky for you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go on with your testimony.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Adam Strauss. I'm a consumer protection attorney here in Minneapolis. I represent Minnesota consumers with low income to no income. As I mentioned, or you had mentioned, Ms. Franson was here to testify. Ms. Franson is a former client of mine, and I was able to represent Ms. Franson solely because of an attorney fee shifting statute. Ms. Franson is a mother of three children. She works full-time. She has student loans. She doesn't have a criminal history, and she was wrongfully harassed. She came to me to help her, and the reason I was able to do it was because of these statutes, and I was proud to do that, and I believe she was happy as well. Let me be perfectly clear. The only motivation to drag on litigation is from the defendants. I don't know one plaintiff's attorney who says, I can't wait to drag this on for 5 years. They want to get done and seek justice for their clients as easily as possible. It's the defendants who are represented, who have clients who pay them by the hour, who want to work for 100 hours, not the plaintiff's attorney. And with that said, again, I was proud to represent Ms. Franson, and I'm sure you don't want to hear from a bunch of attorneys, crying about their fees. So if you want to hear from Ms. Franson, I'd let her finish my time.
Ms. Franson, can you do it in 1 minute? We've got another committee. They're lurking. So please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Franson, like Mr. Strauss said. I am a mother of three beautiful daughters, and basically my rights were violated. I said over and over again to not call me, and they kept violating on a debt that wasn't even mine. So with this fee shifting, what it helped is I was able to hire Adam and actually to help me represent with my rights that were violated. And he's right. My case dragged on for over 18 months. And it's ridiculous. You know, we were basically being charged for, he had to keep on following up with the defendant's attorney, following up. You know, like that's time out of his day when we didn't even get a response. But I technically wouldn't have hired him. So this company would have kept calling me, violating my rights that I know that I have. And I wouldn't have been able to hire an attorney and to seek justice for my rights, because me as a law-abiding citizen has that. And I don't want any company to take that away from me.
Thank you, Ms. Franson. Was an offer ever made in your situation?
Yes.
An offer of settlement?
Yep.
Okay. Representative Knobloch, final word, and then we're going to lay the spill over.
Okay. Well, Madam Chair, I wanted to simply say there's frankly been a lot of really outrageous things just said in the last several minutes. I mean, we're not taking away anyone's rights to hire an attorney. We're not overturning any fee-shifting statutes. People can still hire attorneys, and people can still have the defendant pay for the attorney's fees if they prevail. All we're doing is setting up an incentive for people to settle earlier that already exists underneath Federal Rule 68. So I think a lot of what you've heard here is really, well, I know many of the people, such as the witnesses just spoke, are very well-meaning in what they're saying. I'm certainly not trying to do anything that in any way overturns the human rights statutes. The idea that only proportionality will be considered, as one witness said, The bill doesn't even say that. It just says that attorney fees and proportionality are one thing that will be considered. People can still bring forth lawsuits. They can still bring forth them under contingency. They can still go forth after an offer of settlement has been made if they think they can get a better deal in court than the final judgment, and they're still given the permission to then have all the attorney fees paid if that, in fact, happens. So, Madam Chair and members, a lot of what you've just heard is really not relevant to the bill that is before you. And I'd appreciate your support when we bring the bill up again.
Thank you, Representative Knobloch. The chair lays over House File 923. With that, we are adjourned.